Well, good morning, everybody. We found ourselves at the end of last class making some conclusions about having different slopes on the continuous X, the gestational age, for the different categories of ethnic group. Or at least we found that the slope for the African American mothers was quite a bit different than the slope for white mothers. And so somebody came up after class and asked me a very good leading question about what I was going to do to interpret the indicator variables on the ethnic groups. And that is a perfect link to the sorts of topics we want to talk about today. Because we had the gestational age and ethnic indicator cross products in the model, what I said in response to the question was that because we had those in the model, the indicators themselves don't have much useful interpretation. And the reason I am going to say this is if you look at the model and you say, what happens, for instance, when M black is 1 versus M black, the indicator for the mothers being black is 0, I cannot change that indicator because this change involves another variable moving. If I want to compare M black equal 1 versus M black equal 0, this also implies a change in the cross product involving gestational age times M black. So that when you have cross products like this in the model, you don't necessarily have any interpretation on the indicators because gestational age equals 0 is not a live value. Okay, no baby in this data set has anything like gestational age equals 0. So this was a very important practical application where we found that the cross product told me that the slopes were going to vary. So I'm not going to work with the indicators. So what we have to do today in another example is take a look at the question, what happens if the cross products are not needed? And we're going to do an example today that has four groups. We're going to talk about the follow-up comparisons that I'm going to make in this special case where we actually are going to have 1x. And we'll take the simpler case today where the lines are parallel. So the first page in today's packet is some explanation about multiple comparisons, and we'll be using this as a guide as we work through the new example. But the example from last class with the separate slopes doesn't give us any interpretation on the indicators. So the example we're going to do is actually one I've constructed to illustrate what happens if you have parallel lines. This is a fairly small data set. We have 20 observations in each of four groups. And especially when we have multiple regression available to us as a technique, we're going to start out in this design by setting up our group indicators and cross products. And this is a fairly generic example. I've just called the outcome Y, the explanatory variable X, and then we have four groups. As we pointed out last class, I don't really need to put all four group indicators in the model. What happens is the first model I tried, I used the group 1 as my arbitrary baseline or reference. And so you can see that the first equation I fit has got Y and X. It has the indicators for group 2, 3, and 4. And it has the cross products, X times those indicators. And as we did with the last example, the first thing I'm going to do is look at a null hypothesis that says the coefficients on the three cross products are really zero in the population. And the implication of that, if we don't have the cross product, is that the lines for Y against the X for my groups are parallel, that I have the same slope on every group. And because this is a teacher-constructed example, we're going to have a very large p-value on the test for the cross products. And again, I've used the test command in Stata to help me calculate this, just literally saying, I want to test, are the three cross products on X times group 2, X times group 3, and X times group 4 equal to 0 or not? And the p-value you can see for that test is 0.9745. So we're going to conclude that there's no evidence that different slopes basically are needed. So unlike the example from last class, I'm going to conclude in this one that I can work with the restricted model. And many times when we're working with group comparisons and adjusting for X, people are quite happy if we conclude that there's no evidence the different slopes are needed, because it's going to make our interpretation a lot easier. And remember what we've got here, as I said in bold, there's no evidence that the parallel line model fits worse. So we will use the simpler model because the F test told us we had no evidence we needed the different slopes. So, yeah?
I'm sorry. So you get the F test, even though all those key values individually are so huge, because there's a possibility that in the block they might matter, even if you don't individually?
You don't want to look at your separate p values before you do the overall test. And we'll say this a couple times. The answer to the question is, all right, X times group 2 tells me the slope for group 2 is not different from the slope for the baseline group 1. X times group 3 tells me that the slope for group 3 is not different from the slope for group 1. But what if it turned out that the slopes for group 2 and 3 were different? That one is not in your t-tests. The other thing is, we work towards multiple comparisons. Making a lot of tests puts you at risk of a type 2 error. Okay? And especially in the group context, everybody worries about that. So I want that overall test, which does more than compare the slopes for group 2 and group 1, group 3 and group 1, and group 4 and group 1. Because if the slopes for 2 and 3 were different, the F test would tell me there's something going on. And remember that the choice of the reference group is arbitrary. So I think it's smarter wiser, safer to look at your F test that says, are any of the slopes going to come out different? Because we can make examples where the T tests might look like this, but two non-baseline groups would differ. Okay, and I guess you guys who took 241 didn't get this message. And 145, we tried to do this message, but everybody who takes 145 and then 245 tells me they kind of really get it the second time around. So those of you who haven't had much exposure to this, we're going to give you lots of practice making these cross-product type determinations. The other thing, just historically, before we had a beautiful regress command that you could all have on your computer for less than $200, people often mistakenly assumed parallel lines because it was a lot easier to fit. That's gone with the computer. So we started with allowing for separate slopes and decided that for this data set, we don't need them. The nice thing we're going to get is a fact you have to recover from the past. Parallel lines have the same distance between them for all x. So I'm going to use different slopes if I need them. But if it turns out that I don't have the cross products, it's going to be much easier to compare my groups. If I have a situation where the lines cross, the difference between the lines changes depending what the value of x is. In fact, the way I've drawn this one with the crossing lines, sometimes group A has a higher mean than group B, and sometimes it's the other way around. So you want to check to be sure that you don't need that complicated a model. Whereas here, with the parallel lines, the vertical distance between the lines is the same no matter what the x is. So you can adjust for x in either picture, but what you have to report here with the parallel lines is much simpler than what you have to report if the lines have different slopes. So because we have no evidence from our F test that the parallel line model is going to fit worse, we're going to go ahead and try the one that has a simpler relationship. And because in this example I've only done 1x, one of the advantages is I can actually have Stata make a plot. So what I've done on the next page is a very geeky bunch of Stata where I have fit the line with just x and the indicators, and I have in that model a common slope estimate from this fit. If you take these equations apart and write out the lines, what you're going to find is that for the baseline group 1, where the indicators for 2, 3, and 4 are all 0, my fitted line, the y-hat, is literally going to be the constant 19.4 plus 3.276 times x. Okay? You take a look at that model with just x and the indicators. And my common slope estimate, just to see this in action, if you wrote out the line for group 2 from this equation, asking yourself what I will get for y hat when the indicator for group 2 is equal to 1, we're going to start with the 19.4. we're again going to have 3.276 times x. And then we're going to have plus the coefficient on the group 2 indicator, 14.3, literally times 1. So what I'm going to conclude from looking at these two fitted equations, that the line for group 2 is 14.3 units higher than the line for group 1. But unlike the model we did last class, here this coefficient on the indicator for group 2 has a very practical interpretation. It's the difference between these two groups taking into account any differences in the x. And if you take a look at the plot I have picturing the parallel lines, you can see that in this example, group 1 and group 2 have an overlapping but distinct range of x's. I used some Stata tricks to get this all in one plot, separating the fitted values from the parallel line by the group. And I tricked Stata into using little 1s, 2s, 3s, and 4s according to which group the observations are in. And we'll give you some practice with doing these kinds of plots. But I've got my observed points labeled by which group they're from, and I have there the four parallel lines in the plot. But what happens if you don't have the cross products is you're going to get the same slope estimate for every group. Okay, so if my first F test tells me I'm okay using the parallel lines model, then the next thing we're going to do is another restricted versus full F, and we're going to assume we didn't make a type 2 error on the first test. And the question we're going to ask next goes something like this. Okay, parallel lines seems to be an adequate model. And since we've got ourselves to this point, the next question for our F-test approach is going to have a null hypothesis that says the lines in the population are all the same. So we estimated, using our model, a vertical distance between the lines for group 1 and group 2 that was going to be that coefficient on the group 2 indicator, 14.3. The question is that really significantly different from 0? But instead of just focusing on that comparison, we're going to ask, is there really any difference between them? And in terms of our model, this next question, null hypothesis, basically is about the coefficients on the indicators for the groups in the parallel line model. And so again, I'm going to have a question that says, globally, up or down, are the parallel lines all on top of each other, or are there some differences? And if there are some differences, we're going to talk about the follow-up procedures to figure out which ones. So this F test, and remember with this test command, you have to be really careful because it refers to the last model that you fit. So if you're not sure, refit the model. But what I have is my restricted versus full F test, as I've labeled it, to determine if there are any differences between the group lines. And this one has a very large F value and a P that prints as quadruple zero. So we're going to say that the P value is less than 0.00005. And so we are going to conclude that parallel lines seems to be an adequate model, but that there are some differences between the groups because I got this really low p-value. And the other thing I want to point out about this, in the sequence of tests I've done here, in the first test I did, parallel lines was more restricted than allowing the lines to have different slopes. In this second test we just did, the parallel lines model was actually the fuller one, so that the relationship full versus restricted is relative. Parallel lines is more restrictive than separate slopes, but it's less restrictive than forcing the lines to be identical. But before we move into the follow-up comparisons, it's probably a good idea to think about using our residuals to check some of the assumptions. Yeah?
I was wondering I'm just trying to fit into a real-world model. What sort of variables would we have this kind of relationship to each other and affecting why? Would this be like a dose response kind of
It could be that it could be that X is a dose. And Y is the response. If you take a look, though, at the plot, I have very different ranges of X for the four groups. And where this is really important is a situation where X is not so much a dose that you're giving, but X is something observational. And you are saying, okay, I've got human subjects. If you take a look at that plot, the individuals in group 4 have much higher X's than the individuals in group 1. So if you want to compare group 1 and group 4 and get the X out of there, X could be ages, something like that. With observational data where the people vary on X's that you don't care about, this is really useful to try to statistically move them to where it's as if they were the same X value, where the way I constructed this, if you take a look at it, group 1 has the lowest range of X's, group 2 and 3 are in the middle on the X's, and group 4 has the highest X's. And if you're dealing with something and you say, well, I don't care about their age, I want to know about the variable that flags the groups, this kind of model statistically tries to get the X out of there. Because if you just looked at the average Ys, part of the difference in the average Y for group 4 and group 1 could be due to the X's. And that's what we're trying to take out. Okay, and the thing I wanted this one to look really good for parallel lines, which is why I had to keep it a little abstract and create it. Okay, but before we take these F tests, even for a sample of size 80, I want to make sure that my assumption checks hold so that I can trust the F and the T tests, because I've only got 20 in each group. So we're going to take a look at a residual versus fitted plot for this parallel lines model that it looks like does a pretty good job of describing the data. And so what I have, my standard tests, is the residual versus fitted plot. And even though I now have a continuous X and three group indicators, I'm still asking myself the same questions. Do I have a functional form issue? And I kind of can say that from the plot with the parallel lines, because the little groups of ones, twos, threes, and fours look pretty random and uniform around the lines. But if I added other X's, I'd really be relying on the residual versus fitted plot. So there's no U-shapes. So it's probably true that the relationships are approximately linear. Functional form is at least approximately okay. And then the next thing I worry about, are my group four observations the same variability around the line as the groups one, two, and three? If you think about this, maybe the different groups don't have the same variability around the lines. And remember, I'm going through this in a pretty specific order. If I have a U-shape telling me I have curvature, we're going to go back and revisit the whole model fit. But because we're okay on functional form, we're going to go ahead and ask about the variability of the residuals around that horizontal line that tells me where the residuals are positive or negative. Now, I could have done this with the little ones, twos, threes, and fours as well. I didn't actually do that, but it wouldn't be a bad strategy for a project to figure out how to use the labeling options to do that. But if you take a look at this plot, again, what I'm asking is in each quarter of the range of fitted values, do I have about the same vertical spread in the residual? Okay, and so it looks pretty good all the way across. In particular, we don't have any of these V-type things that would tell me the variability around the lines changed according to the Y-hat. Yeah. Really perverse. I could have a curve in one group and a line in another. Anything can happen.
But that would matter? I mean, that would or is it just that your entire observations are uniform? Is that enough?
Okay, I think both questions, if you push me on this, I think maybe in the B space the version with the ones, twos, threes, and fours will show up tonight. If I had a really strange situation, it could be that one group or one treatment had a curve and the others had a line, and I'd have a very complicated report about how the functional forms between the X and the Y weren't the same. Typically, when people do this, what's kind of in the back of their mind is the X is something like the subject's ages, which is a darn nuisance. If you could get all your patients to be the same age, you'd probably be happier, but that's not going to happen to you. Okay, that's why people do experiments with little mammals, is they can get them all the same age and the same diet and the same life history. But if you've got factors about your individuals that vary, typically, there's a technical term we made out of English. We call them nuisances. Okay? I would love it if my subjects were all the same age, but that's probably not going to happen. But if the functional form changes and your whole disease course is different, if you're older or younger, we want to be able to detect that, which is why I'm thinking this is a good question. And I'm going here for the uniform. But if I put the ones, twos, threes, and fours in, I probably would have more information. So I think I'm gonna do that for you guys. Okay? It's a good question. I'm saying, all right, I'm treating them all as one ensemble, and I don't see any curving, and I don't see any variability. The reason I think the ones, twos, threes, and fours will be a friendly addition is it could be that one group had a bigger variance than the other. And if I just had a megaphone, I wouldn't know if it was a particular group or not. So this plot looks pretty good for the assumptions, but if it were a little more deviant, I probably would want to flag them by the groups. Remember, too, that this is, especially for those of you who joined the class a little late, remember, too, that this is the first check. If I have a problem with the functional form or a problem with the variability, I don't even necessarily want to go on to checking normal curve assumptions, because if I make a box plot or a Q-norm plot of all the residuals together, I've said we're good to treat them as coming from the same distribution. So because the plot on the residual versus fitted looked okay for both assumptions, and I don't really have visual indications of outliers, I'm going to go ahead and do some of the normal curve checks. And the Q-norm plot shows maybe a little bit of wobble. It's not terrible, but there is, especially in the upper end, a little bit of curvature. But we know at this point that the assumptions are at least approximately satisfied. And what I want to do is talk with you about the issue of how I'm going to report my group differences. And although you need to look at your context to do this, in many situations, what the investigators want to do is compare each group with the others. So we're okay, at least roughly, on the normal curve for epsilon. And then if we want to say four groups, basically what we're going to have is six pairs of comparisons. And I'm okay on the normal curve assumption to go to the t-table. The problem is the t-table is calculated for people who are making just one interval or test. And we now have a family of six possible comparisons. And basically, I need more insurance against making a type 1 error. I don't want to write out six confidence intervals and get some that don't include zero when really in the population the difference is zero. So most of the concern you're going to find on this issue is concern about reporting a significant difference when it's not really present in the population. And they did have a little failure of imagination when they made these things up, because this one is just called the type Roman numeral 1 error. Okay? There is another mistake we could make. Okay, a little bit of review on this. What do we call it when we fail to detect a genuine difference? And the answer to that question is that's a type Roman numeral 2 error. Okay, so we should also think about the other way we could have a bad conclusion. We should also think about failing to detect a difference that is really present in the population. Right? We could be wrong. The only thing about this is you can't make them both simultaneously. If you say there's no significant difference, you're at risk of a type 2. If you say there is a significant difference, you're at risk of a type 1, depending on how it comes out. But most people who worry about multiple comparisons are going after controlling the type 1 error. And there's some bad jargon here. There is a concern about a family-wise error rate, or FWER. And we're going to come back to this when everybody's really tired in December and the really last lecture and do some more modern things. But the quick and easy way I'm about to show you how to do this now is 50 years old this year. Professor Dunn from UCLA, her paper was published in 1961. And she read a obscure Italian probability and economics theorist. And 50 years ago, everybody gave her credit. And then somehow her name disappeared. So I'm sort of bringing her back. But the Dunn-Bonferroni idea is based on an easy-to-use inequality. And so what she did is adapted Bonferroni's work to say that if we have S tests or confidence intervals in our family, then using whatever alpha we want, usually 0.05, but using alpha over S in the T table basically is going to guarantee that the family-wise error rate is actually not equal to alpha, but less than alpha. This procedure in the statistical use of the word is conservative. And so that's why we're going to come back at the end of the class and talk about how to wring a little more power out of this. But this is very easy to implement, because all you have to do, if you're going to take a look at your groups, is get yourself a couple of different fits of the model and take a look at things like the coefficients on the indicators. And because the lines are parallel, this is pretty easy to do. So I fit the model a couple of different ways. And we're going to use this model to demonstrate what to do if an effect of interest actually involves two coefficients in the model. But for instance, we have a model with group 1 as the baseline. That's the first model I fit. And what happens in this model, as we've written out, the group 2 indicator represents, with the parallel lines, the vertical distance between the lines for group 1 and group 2. And so when you look in the first way we fit the model with group 1 as baseline, we have a 14.3 for our coefficient estimate, and we have a p-value on the t-test that prints as 0.000, so we know it's less than 0.0005. So if you want to implement this kind of comparison on that model, what you have to do is say, I have 0.0005 as my upper bound, and you just say, is this less than, not 0.05, but 0.05 over 6, which is about 0.083. So this idea for the confidence interval of using alpha over S to get my T, I can also adapt to looking at my p-values, and I just say, is this p-value less than 0.05 over 6? And the answer is yes. If I want to work with the confidence intervals, as wonderful as Stata is, I need to do something a little different to take a look at this. I need to draw a T, and I am going to put down my T with 75 degrees of freedom, because that's the degrees of freedom for residual in this parallel line model. But what I basically want up here in my top tail is 0.025 over 6 rather than 0.025. And I asked Stata to get me that. And basically, Stata says, okay, if you're going to make 6 of these things, you have to use 2.710 for your confidence interval and not something closer to 2. So if you are going to make a set of 6 confidence intervals, you're going to have to use a bigger multiple because of this alpha over S conservative thing. And before you do any of these Bonferroni calculations, you have to be sure you know exactly which comparisons you want to look at. And it's best practice to have specified them before you see the data. If you did not want to make all 6 intervals in the family, if you just wanted to compare, for instance, a control with 3 treatments, you have to specify that before you go to the table, because this changes what your critical values are going to be. Okay, so if you want to make a Bonferroni confidence interval with this 14.3, you can pick the standard error estimate right out of the output. This estimated standard error that goes with this 14.3 is about 3.855. And I've done a ridiculous amount of digits in the handout. But basically what you're going to do is use this 2.710, and you can use the Stata display command. And if you make the calculation using this 14.3 for groups 1 and 2, your done Bonferroni adjusted for the family-wise error rate confidence interval is about 3.85 to 24.75. And again, if you look at the Stata output, it says instead of those limits in the regression, it says something like 6.6 to 22. This is the family of 6 conservative confidence interval, and it does not include 0, but it's wider than if we were just making 1 interval. Now, something that comes up, if you take a look at the model I fit with X and my 3 indicators, group 2, group 3, and group 4, and you look at the lines, the distance between the lines for comparisons like 2 and 3, you can find the point estimate fairly easily. If you take a look at your model fit, and you know that the line for group 2 is 14.3 units above the line for group 1. And then you know the line for group 3 is in here that has a distance of 3.1 above group 1. Then if you look at this picture, it's pretty clear that the distance between group 2 and group 3 is going to turn out to be 14.3 minus 3.1, or 11.2, right? Just looking at the distances. So the comparison between 2 and 3 we can make by taking the group 2 indicator minus the group 3 indicator. Okay, I can get that point estimate fairly easily from the geometry of the picture. If the distance between 1 and 2 is 14.3, and the distance between 1 and 3 is 3.1, then you know what the distance between 2 and 3 is. The trick is getting the standard error estimate is a little harder. And the reason getting the standard error estimate is a little harder is that the coefficients on the regression indicators and X are not statistically independent. And so in your first course, you probably had formulas for things that said the variance of a sum or a difference of random variables started out with the variance of X plus the variance of Y. And if they were independent, you didn't have to worry about this next term minus twice the covariance if it's a difference. Well, Stata has some tools to help us. Stata can give us, if we don't want to shift the baseline, Stata can tell us where the X and Y are our coefficient indicators on groups 2 and 3, what that covariance is. And we can calculate the standard error using that formula, or we can talk about how to use the Stata linear combinations command to look at this difference. And we'll fill that in next time so that you have all the tools you need to compare all the groups.